This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we speak with Dr. Lassay, who is an environmental toxicologist, MS and PhD, specializing in analytical chemistry, exposure, environmental fate and transport, and per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS. His discovery of PFOS in insecticides made national news. Dr. Lassay also runs an occupational and environmental consulting firm that specializes in safety training, risk assessment and communication, environmental toxicology, and the chemical group PFAS. We will provide his website in the show notes. Today, Dr. Lassay explains what PFAS are, how they affect our health, how we are exposed to these toxicants, and how we can reduce exposure. These chemicals are everywhere, and being aware of the exposure and how to avoid them can help us live healthier lives. I learned a lot from this conversation and hope you do too. Now, onto the podcast. Hi, Dr. Lassay. Welcome to the Nuance Podcast. I'm really excited to have you as a guest today. I heard your feature on one of my favorite podcasts, the Food Sleuth Radio. So I'm really excited to bring you onto our podcast and talk about environmental toxicants and specifically PFAS.
Yeah. Thank you, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I would love to just start out with a general basic question. What are PFAS? And also, what does that stand for?
So PFAS, PFAS. One thing I wanted to point out, my wife, she'll see like media, like on Instagram and stuff like that. And people will call them PFAS, like you did, or PFA. And then think the S stands for, like, you know, plural. They're actually PFAS, polyfluoroalkyl substances. So the S actually stands for substances. They were in the past referred to as PFCs or polyfluoral compounds, right? But we've switched the naming convention to polyfluoroalkyl substances. And what that really means is, well, alkyl is just a carbon chain, right? So if you think of like a lipid or something like that, it's this big carbon chain with a bunch of hydrogens on it. Well, the polyfluoral part means that the hydrogens have been removed and fluorines have been added. Well, that's significant because fluorines are, well, the carbon fluorine bond is one of the strongest bonds in organic chemistry. So basically you take this molecule and you put some of the strongest bonds available on it and it becomes very, very stable. And these molecules can be functionalized by adding different components to them. There's about 13,000 different PFAS, I guess, is the estimate right now. So there's a group of 13,000 different chemicals. As you can imagine, there's a great deal of variation in that group. And even from a toxicology standpoint, you know, can 13,000 chemicals really be grouped together effectively? Yeah, it's a little more difficult. The group of chemicals that in PFAS that we're most concerned about right now, at least, and this number keeps growing, is about 50 different chemicals or so, and the precursors to those chemicals. And when I say precursor, think of like so if you have a target chemical you're concerned about and there's another chemical in the environment that breaks down into that target chemical, that other chemical would be considered a precursor. So PFAS have typically been used because they're incredibly stable. As I said before, they're very environmentally resistant to degradation and biologically as well. They're amphipathic, or members of the group are amphipathic, which means that they are both resistant to water and oil. So when I was a kid, there were often like videos of people spraying stuff on their pants, and all of a sudden, oh, they put water on it and it just flies off, and they put oil on it and it just flies off. And well, that was PFAS that they were spraying on their pants, and products like Scotch Guard used to have a lot of them in them, and I still think they do have PFAS in them. They're also kind of, can't think of the word right now, but electrically resistant. So a lot of PFAS are sprayed on electrical components to prevent short circuits and things like that. As I said before, they're used in nonstick things in the creation of nonstick surfaces like Teflon. They were also extensively used in firefighting foams. They've been applied to things to aid in dispersing because they are also surfactants, which means they like to cover the surface of something. So firefighting foams, if you have like an oil fire you can't put out, you spray PFAS over the top of it, it spreads out over the surface of the oil fire, and then smothers it by making a barrier between, you know, the oil and the air.
Wow. Right.
I think that's a good explanation, I guess.
Yes, that, I mean, it's a very, like you said, 13,000 chemicals, so it's a broad topic. And I was just wondering too, so there's obviously there's chemicals that humans make and then chemicals that can be found, you know, in the environment. So are any of these PFAS found naturally in the environment, or are they all human created?
So as far as I know, none of them are naturally created. But as I said, there's 13,000 of them. So maybe somebody can point out one of them and say, hey, this is the PFAS that's naturally created. Well, the ones we're concerned about are certainly not. So the two kind of PFAS of highest concern right now are PFOS and PFOA, which are both, if you can imagine, like an 8-chain fatty acid kind of thing, where all the hydrogens are now fluorines, and then it either has a carboxylic acid group at the end or a sulfonic acid group. So, as I said before, fatty acid chain, and I just described basically a fatty acid that has had its hydrogens replaced with fluorines. So you can imagine it somewhat has similar behavior in a body potentially to those fatty acids, which is potentially where some of that toxicity comes in.
And do you think that these are the two that we're most concerned about because they have the most research surrounding them?
Yeah, almost certainly. They definitely have the most research surrounding them. And that's mostly because of historic use. They were used a lot in the past. They're not as much now, but as I said before, they're resistant to degradation, so they still show up all over the place.
So you mentioned a couple of places where we can see these chemicals in our day-to-day life, including, you know, nonstick pans, in clothing that you mentioned. So for the population that may not be familiar with these chemicals and chemical exposures, where can we see these chemicals day-to-day and how can we avoid being exposed to them?
Yeah, often the products that they're applied to that the average person deals with, like you said, are have some sort of nonstick component to them. So Gore-Tex, you know, water and weather resistant clothing has been and is treated with PFAS chemicals. That's true of basically almost nearly all of those similar sorts of products in the past. Maybe not as much now, and I know that a lot of companies are moving away from that, which is good. They're also found in nonstick sort of cooking supplies, right? So like classically nonstick pans will have, you know, PFOS, PFOA free. Granted, those are two chemicals out of a whole, you know, 13,000 chemical group. So there are substitutes for that. So, but in general, a lot of times non-stick pans aren't like a terribly high source of PFAS exposure. More often it's stuff like, packaging for food. So as I said before, they're water and oil resistant, and a lot of our food that tastes good has water and oil in it. So historically, a lot of packaging has been treated with PFAS. So like a lot of fast food containers, processed food containers, things like that. It ends up in the food itself. And a lot of my research has been focused around plant uptake and subsequent exposure to humans and organisms of soil PFAS, right? So plants uptake this stuff and it ends up getting accumulated in their tissues, which, you know, can be directly consumed by humans and or indirectly consumed through animals. Additionally, things like chickens and pigs will rut through a lot of the soil and pick at stuff. You know, chickens pick up stones to fill their crop with stones so they can better digest food. And then they, you know, pick around in the soil. And as a result, I think like pigs and chickens propose exposure something like 60 to 80% of their PFAS exposures from the soil. But cows also will, you know, eat potentially contaminated hay, and that will lead to exposure in their muscle and milk. And as I mentioned before, you can just eat the plants directly and get exposed to there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So pretty much anything that we eat, even if you're vegetarian, carnivore, paleo, whole foods diet, whatever, you'll yeah. be exposed.
Yep. Oh, something like 80 to 90% of a person's, the average person's exposure is going to come through their mouth, right? So either through food, contaminated water, which the government is quite concerned about, or you can breathe it in through dust, and some of them are volatile. So meaning they'll just be in the air around manufacturing and things like that.
And I would love to talk about the research on the health effects of PFAS. PFAS. Wait, which one?
PFAS.
PFAS.
Yep.
Okay.
So the first thing I would like to say is that a lot of PFAS, especially the ones we've studied and connected to health concerns, have incredibly long biological half-lives, right? So they're not metabolized in the body. So metabolism is usually the process of turning like a toxic chemical into something that's more water soluble, so you can, you know, urinate it out. You can't really do that with PFAS. So they kind of just float around your system until they, you know, diffuse their way out, more or less. So a lot of these chemicals, especially the longer ones, like the PFOS and PFO, will have biological half-lives in the years, right? So some of them are, you know, 1 years, and some estimates are like 10 years for PFOS or PFHXS, which are two chemicals in the group. And then there are even longer ones that we don't really necessarily know what the biological half-life is, but they're longer, so you would assume they're even have an even longer biological half-life. And with that comes the difficulty in figuring out toxic effects. How do you pinpoint a toxic effect to something that's been in your body for a decade, right? Although we have found correlations with certain toxicities, and PFAS also have the interesting fact that they're kind of uniquely bioaccumulative in humans. So a lot of our model species that you might do research on, like rats, mice, and monkeys, actually excrete them much faster than we do, and as a result may not experience the same toxicological effects, right? But there are some things we've seen and have correlated PFAS exposure to, like weakened immune function is a big one. And in that, there's kind of lowered vaccine responses, lowered antibody concentrations, greater occurrence of childhood infections, and they might be correlated with some autoimmune issues and allergies. Thyroid disease and elevated thyroid stimulating hormone is something we've seen. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease might be associated with higher concentrations of PFAS exposure. We see increase in serum lipid and cholesterol concentrations with greater PFAS exposures. Increase in human insulin resistance, which is associated with the dysregulation of lipogenesis activities as well, and maybe even to diabetes. There's also a positive correlation with uric acid in serum, which itself is correlated with increased risk of renal diseases. It might be correlated with kidney cancer. We've also seen lower sperm counts, qualities, and lower testosterone levels, and modestly correlated with testicular cancer. And then in babies, we've seen lower birth weights and head sizes. And while like having a smaller head, you know, typically leads to a smaller brain. And while you can look at my brain and your brain, and they may be different sizes, and that necessarily doesn't relate to intelligence. But if I were to take your brain and shrink it, that is likely correlated with lowered intelligence, which is not great. And also, young people who have higher exposures to PFAS tend to have greater BMIs later in life. But as I kind of mentioned before, PFAS are in a lot of foods that tend to be, you know, fast foods, processed foods, things like that. Foods that aren't all that healthy in the first place. So that might also be factoring in with some of these things as well.
And I know that a lot of times people are like questioning, you know, how the chemical exposures affect their health. But I mean, the CDC even has it on their website for exposures in people, and that it affects people's health. So, yeah. I mean, you're also a PhD and a researcher. So there's definitely a lot of research surrounding these chemicals and the possible health effects.
And just because I want to always be utmostly correct, that a lot of people who tend to have very high exposures to PFAS are associated with one, like typically some sort of large exposure source, right? So whether that be like a contamination site or nearby manufacturing, but they also tend to also be exposed to many other things in addition to that. Now that doesn't wave away anything else, but it just makes it more complicated to pinpoint toxic effects to PFAS, because like I said, their toxicity isn't necessarily acute. You know, it's more of a chronic sort of thing, and they stick around for a very long time.
That's a very good point. And I was working with some populations along the Mississippi River when I was in medical school in New Orleans, and it was really difficult to elucidate where the health effects were coming from, because the populations were, you know, suffering from a lot of chronic health diseases or rare cancers. And because you can only study really like one chemical in isolation, but they were exposed to so many different environmental toxicants that it was really difficult to elucidate what was causing what. And that was one of the barriers that those populations faced for you know, large scale changes.
And well, synergistic effects or additive effects, right? So like, while all of these things might factor in a little bit, it might be the little bit that's necessary to push you over the edge as far as a lot of these toxic effects go, you know?
Exactly. Yes. And I've heard, I used to live in Europe as well, but I've heard that in Europe, especially for food specifically, you have to test the chemical in the effect of like human health before you introduce it to the market.
Yeah.
Do they have less PFAS in Europe, or is it ubiquitous?
Actually, I think, you know, it's going to depend on sites and studies and all kinds of different that things like that. But actually, I believe Europe has higher PFAS than we do. Granted, as I said before, PFAS have interesting chemistry, and it can result in them having interesting movement throughout the environment that might not always make sense. But one thing that it does do is long-range transport. And it appears, you know, chemicals that are long-range transported means basically they hijack, you know, some sort of pathway, right? So like, okay, PFAS ends up, you know, adhered to a piece of dust, and that piece of dust flies up in the air and goes somewhere and lands down, and ta-da, you have PFAS somewhere where you wouldn't expect it, right? Or I mentioned precursors before, right? Now, this is kind of a silly explanation, but it does make sense. It's so imagine you have a horse, and we live in a world where unicorns aren't seen as like strange and out of the ordinary, right? Well, you take that horse and you tape a horn to its head, and all of a sudden it's a unicorn, right? Well, then it can get into the unicorn club, and it's no big deal. But, you know, once it gets into the unicorn club, time goes by, and oddly enough, the horn you tape onto his head falls off. All of a sudden, you have a horse in the unicorn club, and you're not sure how it got there, right? That can kind of happen with PFAS precursors, is that there's a certain aspect added to this PFAS compound that changes its chemistry, maybe makes it able to be, you know, volatilized. It gets up into the atmosphere, that part gets knocked off, and then it falls down to the earth or wherever else, right? And all of a sudden you have PFAS in a place where you didn't think it could get. And it would appear that Europe, especially like Scandinavia, might be a place where that is happening, is that PFAS get wet and dry, depositioned into, you know, Scandinavia. But even more so than either Europe or the US or North America, Asia has a lot of PFAS, and so does actually Australia too. They have a lot of PFAS exposure. It's probably mostly related to manufacturing, in all honesty, and they don't have the best environmental regulations over there, typically.
Very interesting. So we've kind of defined the issue. PFAS are everywhere. They do have effects on our health. I was just wondering specifically, how did you get interested in studying environmental toxicants?
Well, so after undergrad, for me, I ended up working at the Aurora Research Institute, which is a research institute associated with the Aurora Healthcare System in Wisconsin. And I did clinical studies, and I dealt with people who are sick all the time, and I dealt with people who are chronically sick all the time. I kind of spent some time there and thought about it, and I decided that, you know, instead of trying to become a doctor or something like that, I'm going to try to stop people from getting sick in the first place. And well, that led me to environmental toxicology. And I ended up going to finding an advisor or mentor that I liked at Texas Tech. And when I went to his lab, he basically told me, hey, I've started studying these chemicals, in this case, PFAS. I don't really have any projects for you at the moment, so go try to figure something out. So that's what I did, and I mostly did research on human exposure, you know, that was my focus. And I did that through plant uptake studies. I got a breast milk study that should be coming out, and I've surveyed a lot of sites and stuff like that, and looked at kind of how PFAS moves throughout the environment and how that contamination happens. And basically, I was given a chemical to invest myself into, and I became, you know, very interested in it because, as it seemed before, these things are everywhere. They have, you know, very hard to predict behaviors, and it was a good puzzle for me to solve. So I invested myself into it. I just ended a fellowship at the EPA in here in Duluth, and I was looking to gain more experience with PFAS and aquatic environments and how that pans out. I also spent a lot of time like tracking down contamination while I was there, because a lot of laboratory equipment is contaminated with PFAS, and a lot of other things are too. And if you're doing research on PFAS and you're using equipment that's contaminated with PFAS, it can throw off your results.
Wow. That's so interesting. And thank you for doing this work, because as a resident physician, it gets very frustrating when you see people come in sick and ill with these chronic diseases, and you know that it could have been prevented upstream. So I really do appreciate that.
Yeah. The unfortunate part of like my profession is that it's very reactive, right?
Yeah.
You kind of find out things are toxic often after they're on the market. And that's not necessarily any one person's fault or anything like that, because a lot of times how things become toxic is hard to predict. And, you know, in the case of PFAS, they're in your body for decades. So, yeah, studying that is difficult. And you can't do studies on humans. You know, that's unethical. And turns out, you know, PFAS are more accumulative in humans than like our model organisms. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Dr. Lassay, how do we prevent our exposure to these chemicals? And like, what do you do in your daily life? And is there any way to like detox from these?
Oh, I can tell you right now, the way people are detoxed from PFAS is essentially bloodletting. PFAS accumulate mostly in proteins, and it would appear that they accumulate, you know, in blood. They end up in your blood quite a bit. So they do bloodlettings to slowly reduce the amount of PFAS in your body, which, you know, is interesting.
Wow. Who's they?
Well, doctors.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're typically associated with some sort of researcher, because it's not like there's exactly like a known, you know, protocol for this, right? And people who they typically do this to have very, very, very high exposures. And, you know, it's kind of like, I worked in, you know, hospital research, and there were things like humanitarian use devices that didn't require extensive testing because they tended to affect a small population of people, right? So similarly, we don't exactly have something nailed down or some chemical that they can give you or anything like that. It's just bloodletting.
just releasing some of your blood.
Yep. But as far as how to reduce exposures, I had mentioned before products that have this contamination, right? Packaging, things like that, nonstick surfaces. Am I saying don't, you know, wear a weatherproofed coat? I haven't really been able to look and see if that's a tremendously big source. Although if you do have a weatherproof coat, I would not suck on it, right? Because as I said before, a lot of this exposure comes through your mouth, right? And children tend to have exposure sources that are, you know, outside of that food, that 90%+ exposure that was coming through your mouth, because kids love to shove things in their mouth.
Lead exposure happens and such.
Exactly. Well. Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of people who have high exposures to PFAS, it tends to be associated with proximity to a contamination site or some sort of product or food that, you know, was either near a contamination site or grown on a contamination site. Those are good ways. If you are very concerned, you can get your water tested, but that'll cost a bit of money. You can just be aware of contamination sites that pop up. Honestly, that's the average person. If they're really concerned about reducing their PFAS exposure, is pay attention if contamination sources pop up around you and then react accordingly, and then reduce, you know, the consumption of packaged food right now. Hopefully that changes in the future, but yeah, there have been correlation studies showing that people who eat more processed and fast food tend to have higher blood levels of a variety of different PFAS. And also, like, microwave popcorn is one. There have also been some studies showing that, like, use of personal care products, like lotions, makeups, and things like that, people who had a lot of that use tended to have higher blood levels. Now, does that mean that they're in the products? I believe there's been research showing that there are a variety of makeup products and things like that that do have PFAS in them. But I don't know if they're added intentionally or whatnot, but I imagine companies that are concerned about that are working to remove that.
Great. Thank you so much. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
And we only have about 5 minutes left. So lastly, we ask all of our guests to finish the following sentence. The future is blank.
I would say the future is malleable. We can do with it what we choose to.
Well, Dr. Lasay, thank you so much for your time and explaining PFAS.
Yeah.
PFAS.
there was one question you had for me that we didn't touch on that I actually feel like I should answer. Policy changes, right?
Yes.
The government is mostly concerned with PFAS and water, right? But a massive source of PFAS potential in the environment is our waste treatment biosolids, right? Now, when I was a kid, it was all the fad to apply these biosolids to agricultural fields as fertilizers. Well, it turns out a lot of them might have a lot of PFAS in them. So I believe that needs to be something that's looked at. And maybe these biosolids need to be tested before they can be applied.
That was perfect. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I really appreciate it. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. Keep doing this really important work. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Yeah. Well, you have a great day, and thank you for inviting me on, Amanda.